You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Blake and Ulig, PA, and Pipefitters, Local 533. Since 1972, Blake and Ulig has prided itself on providing comprehensive legal representation to labor organizations and their affiliated benefit funds on a local, regional, and national basis. And Pipefitters, Local 533, is a proud, diverse union specializing in many aspects of the piping industry. We're involved with and support various charities, community programs, community organizations, as well as specialized training for our veterans returning home from service. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, it's Christmas Eve, in case you haven't noticed it, and Santa is loading the sled with toys. But hark, the elves are on strike, and we'll tell all on tonight's show about what really goes on in Santa's workshops. Stay tuned to find out the naughty and nice about toy makers. And that's not all. We'll celebrate labor with some great holiday songs like The Year the Elves Went on Strike by Barry Rabin and Julie McCall's Rudolph the Union Reindeer, sung by our own Ariana Eckel. In the news, labor is playing an important get-out-the-vote role in Georgia, and construction jobs actually increased this year in Kansas City. And now for the news.
Now, news from our side, December 24, 2020. The American Prospect writes about union activism to help swing the Georgia Senate vote. At a labor rally ahead of the first day of early voting in Georgia's January 5th Senate runoffs, Yvonne Taylor Brooks, Secretary Treasurer for Georgia AFL-CIO, delivered a simple message. Electing Democrats John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock isn't simply about running up the score for a political party. Instead, victory preserves the chance for a brighter future where all of Georgia workers have a safe working environment and a voice on the job, and where right to work is just a terrible memory. 2 days later, at a Unite Here rally, Nsei Yufut, CEO of the New Georgia Project, wrapped her greeting in similar demands. I want to say good morning to the 15 and a union voters. I want to say good morning to the one job should be enough voters. I want to say good morning to the South Got Something to Say voters. She continued, we're not giving a gift to the candidates, Yufut said. We are voting to build a world that we want to live in. Voting is a tool we use to protect ourselves. With 10 million unemployed due to COVID-19, 40 million facing eviction, a homeless pandemic looming, and nearly 15 million who have lost health insurance, the outcome in Georgia is crucial for working people. So our unions have swung into overdrive. SEIU has pledged to make 3 million calls. The Georgia AFL-CIO, according to President Charlie Fleming, has made over 107,000 phone calls to Georgia union members already, visited thousands of doors, and sent 50,000 text messages. And just last week, Unite Here, a group of 500 canvassers that aims to knock on 1 million doors in Georgia, Daniel Blackman, a progressive candidate for Georgia's Public Service Commission, whose runoff is also January 5th. Put it at the rally, Georgia can't win without labor. We can't win without standing up for our working families. We cannot win if you guys aren't organized. Gone are the days of people forgetting that we're here because of labor. Labor no doubt agrees and is asking its Senate hopefuls to put it in writing. Every speaker, for instance, drew tight and explicit links between union support and the candidate's willingness to champion policies that stand to improve both working people's lives and unions' bargaining power.
As if to illustrate the importance of the Georgia race, the HuffPost writes, starting January 1st, employers will no longer have to give workers with COVID-19 or those taking care of someone with the virus 2 weeks of paid leave. Congress is letting the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, or FFCRA, paid leave guarantee expire at the end of the month without an extension. The $900 billion relief package Congress just passed late Monday, which Trump is yet to sign, does extend tax credits for employers offering paid leave until March. That means the federal government will pay for paid sick leave for another 3 months, but businesses are no longer required to offer it. Of course, the FFCRA leave only required employers with less than 500 or more than 50 employees to provide leave. Some larger employers voluntarily did so, but a number has stopped, forcing workers either to work sick or take the time off without pay if they have the virus. The expiring FFCRA also mandates 2 weeks of paid leave for those caring for someone required to quarantine and 10 weeks of emergency child care leave if schools or child care facilities are shut down, paid out at 2/3 of the worker's regular salary. Employers were given a refundable tax credit to cover the costs of paying out paid sick leave. Democrats' hope of extending the mandate for paid leave into the new year as COVID-19 cases continue to rise across the country were blocked by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Senator Lamar Alexander. According to a senior Democratic aide, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin told House Speaker Nancy Pelosi that Republicans felt renewing the mandate would put the policy on a path to permanency, which they wanted to block. In other words, Republicans will block legislation to pay workers with COVID to stay home because they're afraid of a future paid sick or paid family leave law.
And here's some good news on Kansas City jobs. If you read the Kansas City Labor Beacon, you'll actually see employment ads. For instance, in the current issue, there's an ad that says we need roofers immediately, and it promises 40 plus hours a week. In fact, both Kansas City and Springfield, unlike most of the rest of the country, have had increases in construction employment. Indeed, they are in the top 10 of 358 metro areas in jobs in construction. Such jobs increased by 12% or 3,700 jobs in the last year. Springfield, Missouri is even higher with a 15% gain. Don Greenwell, president of the Builders Association, which is the organization of many union contractors, said, top among them are the thousands of jobs the KCI new airport terminal project has added. 600 workers were on the job building KCI this fall, and overall, that project will create 5,000 jobs. The news was read tonight by Judy Ansel and myself, Tom Gebke.
On tonight's show, we'll have some fun and talk consumer issues along with some worker issues. It's hard to separate them. And because it's Christmas Eve and you just might be wrapping presents, we're going to talk about toy makers
the naughty and the nice ones. To kick off our show and throughout, we're going to have a few union-friendly Christmas songs, starting with a song called The Year the Elves Went Out on Strike. And this one is from Barry Raven.
T'was 3 days before Christmas in 1982. At Santa's North Pole workshop, there was lots of work to do. A million toys they had to make for lots of little tykes. When all at once the elves cried out, "We're going out on strike!" Oh, Debbie almost didn't get her dolly, and Billy almost didn't get his bike, and little girls and boys almost didn't get their toys the year the elves went out on strike. The little elfin leader read a list of their demands. He said, "We want brand new outfits and new work gloves for our hands. A little elf gymnasium where we can have some fun. And 3 paid weeks in Florida when Christmas time is done." Oh, Debbie almost didn't get her dolly, and Billy almost didn't get his bike, little girls and boys almost didn't get their toys the year the elves went out on strike. When Santa heard the elves' demands, they made him really cross. He said, "You elves are forgetting that up here I am the boss. And if you don't get back to work and give up on the strike, I'll get my toys from China and you elves can take a hike." Oh, Debbie almost didn't get her dolly, and Billy almost didn't get his bike, and little girls and boys almost didn't get their toys the year the elves went out on strike. But Mrs. Claus soon heard the news and called her husband's phone. She said, "Claus, have you gone crazy? You can't run this place alone. Those boys are just like family, so please don't be a jerk. Negotiate a settlement and get them back to work." So Santa called his lawyers in, and soon the deal was done. The elves ran up and hugged him, and everyone had won. They all worked double shifts until they'd made a million toys, and Santa made deliveries to happy girls and boys. Oh, Debbie almost didn't get her dolly, and Billy almost didn't get his bike, and little girls and boys almost didn't get their toys the year the elves went out on strike. The elves went out on strike.
That was The Year the Elves Went Out on Strike from Barry Raven. We're starting with the nice. Did you know that the AFL-CIO has a department called the Union Label Department? They publish a list of union-made products. They have do-buy lists and don't-buy lists, depending on how the companies treat their workers. They even have an app, so you can look things up while you shop. They also list cars, who makes them and where. Just go to unionlabel.org. Right now, they have a whole section for the holidays, which includes their labor movement relief funds, where you can donate to unemployed actors, musicians, and even hospitality workers. But a much more up-to-date guide to ethical shopping is a site we just found called Labor 411. Their slogan is "Making it easy to support good jobs." It's run by Sherry Senders, who is joining us from California. Sherry works with Daniel Cardozo, CEO of Ethics Merchandise. That's merchandise with a mission. Daniel is joining us too. He's in Massachusetts. Welcome to both of you to the Heartland Labor Forum Christmas Eve Santa's Workshop Naughty and Nice Exposé. Let's start with you, Sherry. Give us an overview of Labor 411.
Labor 411 was created about 12 years ago just because I wanted to find good places to shop. I like to say that in the union movement, when you join, you are required to take an oath to buy union products. And of course, we make it as difficult as possible to do that. So I decided to create an easy shoppable list. And then that's how we got started. We now have 5 books. We work with 5 central labor councils around the country. We work with the Los Angeles, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, and New York City Central Labor Council. And then we have a very robust social media presence, too, just talking about ethical consumerism, the value of harnessing our dollars, and just actual things that you can do. We ask people to, it's not practical to ask people to have 100% of their shopping be union made or ethically sourced and helping create good jobs, but we ask for 10%. So we say when you're shopping, if you could make 10% of your shopping basket be union made and ethically made, then that would be terrific.
Well, gosh, if you buy a car in a year, that'll take care of it, won't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Car gets you lots of points.
Yeah. Well, I not only have a union-made car, I have a union-made car made in Kansas City.
And you get double points for that, Judy.
Oh, thank you. Okay. All right. So I get a year off, right? Okay. Now to you, Daniel. What is ethics? That's ethics with an X. Merchandise do.
Ethics connects organizations who want to purchase responsibly with the actual merchandise, and mostly focused on custom printed merchandise. Unions are our bread and butter client, and unions need swag with their logo and their message on it all year for their rallies and member giveaways. And so we connect them with union manufacturers and USA manufacturers all across the country. So Sherry was mentioning it can be difficult to find ethical merchandise, and so that's why ethics is here to help unions and other socially responsible organizations find that merch. Ethics was started back in 2006, and it was the outgrowth of another company called SweatX, which people who remember what the labor movement's response was to globalization back in the late 90s. This was one such effort, and SweatX was founded with money from Ben and Jerry's, from Ben Cohen, who was actively involved in combating sweatshops in that time. And SweatX was a unionized worker-owned facility in Los Angeles. And SweatX lasted about 3 or 4 years. And one of the lessons of SweatX, which went under, was that the folks who were really could drive the movement towards union and ethical purchasing was actually the organizations, the institutional purchasing. SweatX was focused more on retail and individuals. And so the anti-sweatshop movement at large sort of realized back in the early 2000s that we needed to get our organizations practicing what they preach and purchasing ethically themselves using their organizational budgets. And once we kind of got that straightened out, we could move on to the larger individuals. Of course, it has to happen at the same time, but Sherry's Labor 411 organization is mostly focused on individuals, and ethics is focusing on building that demand amongst organizations, progressive and union-friendly, labor-friendly organizations.
The thing we share, though, Judy, the thing that we do share is the at the heart of both of our movements, of what we're doing, is supporting good jobs and creating good jobs through our consumer dollars. With consumerism at 70% of GDP, we have huge amount of power as consumer to harness our dollars for the good. And we're saying our spec is about worker justice and making sure that workers have good jobs with those consumer dollars.
So, you know, boycotts are really hard to win, and that's a kind of consumer action that, you know, has been used a lot in the labor movement, but they take a long time and they're hard to win. What makes you think that consumer consciousness is going to be any more successful?
I think that millennials are going to save us. I find that my children care very much about how they spend their dollars. There's something, a movement called fast fashion where millennials are recycling their clothing. They're not willing to just buy needless clothing. They really want to recycle. They want to save the planet. So I think the more that we can reconnect with the environmental movement and fold in worker justice into that, I think the more successful we will be.
Yeah, I think it takes movement building. And I think there just hasn't been enough energy directed yet at it. I think you have a large enough base of folks who care. The studies have been shown that individuals and organizations really want to do the right thing in their purchasing. It's just that things get in the way. Nobody's really standing up and asking people to do the right thing in a sort of coordinated way. And so that's part of what we're doing in collaboration with Labor 411, is we're finding these folks at both the individual and institutional organizational level who say, yes, of course we should be doing this. Of course we should be buying ethically and doing the research to figure out how to not support sweatshops and terrible working conditions. But they've also got their own budgets to deal with, and nobody's holding their feet to the fire. So that's where the organization comes in. If we can present materials and make it easier for folks, use a little bit of peer pressure, really wave the flag when somebody does make that right decision, then I think we can really get over the top. There's nothing really stopping us from doing that other than it's just hard.
Sherry, you have a lot of recommendations on your website for Christmas and I would add New Year's. I want to focus first on toys. What are ethical toys? How do you judge that, and what are they?
Our spec about ethical toys, because we're concerned about worker justice, is wherever workers are treated fairly and have a voice on the job. So we go with anything that has a collective bargaining agreement behind it. So anything that is union made, we know that has workers have a voice in creating those things. So so much of what we do is making it fun to do the right thing and making it fun to buy union. And people don't realize those. So many of the aha moments. I didn't know that Hasbro, I didn't know that Little Ponies, I didn't know that G.I. Joe was union made. So I can feel good about making those kind of decisions every day. Disney's Frozen, again, another sort of licensed product that are, you know, everything from the action figures to the games are all union made. So people can feel good about knowing that workers are protected and workers have a voice in these kind of products.
You know, we're going to do an interview later on in the show with a researcher from China Labor Watch, and she told me that Barbies are made in China under sweatshop conditions. And I thought, oh, gosh, so many people think that those are great gifts. So what would you counter if somebody wants to get a Barbie? What would you say?
Well, there are other action figures. They can do everything from Play-Doh. Like I said, Frozen is sort of one of the hot commodities this year and last year. Mr. and Mrs. Potato Head. There's all sorts of other things that they can do besides Barbie. And I think that it is, I'm going to agree with Daniel very much. It's about raising consciousness and giving people alternatives. These are the good toys. These are the nice toys. These are the naughty toys.
So, Daniel, why don't you expand some on what are your standards? What's an ethical job? And, you know, what are you really promoting people's consciousness to be?
Sure. So it all stems back to the workers. Are the workers being treated fairly? Are they empowered? Is their voice respected on the job? Are they being paid a living wage? Are they safe in their jobs? So those are the main things. And there are various ways to get at that. So ethics in our 14 years has focused predominantly on union made and made in USA factories. Wherever possible, we steer folks to those union factories for the reason that if something goes wrong in those factories and there's unsafe conditions or nefarious practices by the bosses and by the owners, then the union is going to raise that flag and make a big fuss about it, and we'll know about it right away. So union membership by the factory workers is really the gold standard. We do sell a lot of made in USA with union bug print items. And that's because here in the USA, we can mainly, at least in our industry, depend on at least the minimum wage being respected and basic labor standards being protected. Once you get outside the United States, it becomes much more of a tricky business. European countries is generally fine, but if you get into those garment producing countries, that's sort of like the Wild West, and there's no way really to know whether the workers are being treated fairly. And as organizations like International Labor Rights Forum and Garment Worker Center will tell you, that there's the reason that companies are going to those garment producing countries to make their products is specifically because they don't have to pay decent wages and they don't have to worry about conditions. So subcontracting is a real boon for the large apparel and other manufacturers. At Ethics, what we do is we start with where are the good jobs right now, where are the living wages, where are the manufacturers who want to start from respecting employees and making sure they have those good wages and good conditions right now.
So do you screen non-union American-made products for those kinds of standards? Because there's a lot of sweatshops in the U.S.
Yeah, so that's why we're very particular about the American-made sources that we use. It's typically in fast fashion. There's lots of terrible stories about sweatshop conditions in the garment areas of Los Angeles, for example, a famous case of slave labor being used in El Monte, California. And so we develop our relationships with our American manufacturers. We visit them. We make sure that their doors are open to us and that they're open with us about wages and conditions. Over time, we want to be where the manufacturing is, and 95% of the garment industry is outside the United States. So we want to be sourcing from outside the United States. We just need those conditions to be brought up to speed.
So Sherry, how much more expensive are those union-made products you're featuring at Labor 411 than if you bought something, you know, that wasn't union-made or was foreign?
Yeah, I know it's a myth that union-made is always more expensive, but it's actually not true. Sometimes it can be pennies more, sometimes it can be pennies less than the competing products. One of the sort of a standard one would be Land O'Lakes butter. If you go to the store, Land O'Lakes butter is union made. It's a co-op. It's a farmer's co-op. It's a terrific, it's sort of the ideal situation where workers are treated well, the workers benefit from the work of their labor. And then you go to the next brand, and like I said, it's within pennies, and often it is the same price. The same with toys, the Hasbro toys that I was just mentioning, Easy Bake Oven. I mean, who doesn't remember Easy Bake Oven from, there's a certain generation of girls that, of course, remember that growing up with the Easy Bake Oven. All those sorts of products are very, very competitive with their non-union counterparts. So the difference is where the money, the allocation of where the money goes and how the workers are treated.
How can people find out more about you? And any last words you want to say?
Well, we have a very robust directory online, www.labor411.org. We have print books, and we have a very robust presence on social media. We have we reach about 1 million people a week on our Facebook page. And again, it would be Facebook Labor 411. And we're on, like I said, we're on social media. So we can reach us digitally and in print.
And you also have suggestions for Happy New Year celebrations on your webpage if you want to do it ethically, right?
Yes, absolutely. One of the fun things that we like to do, or one of the things that I'm most proud of, is we make it fun to buy union. Instead of wagging a finger at people, we try and make it fun and creative. So yes, you can have an ethical union hangover relief, and that would be everything from Advil to Poland water to and some good coffees that you can have that are all union made and ethically sourced.
That was Sherry Senders from Labor 411, and to you, Daniel, how can people find out more about you?
Well, our website is ethicsmerch.com. That's ethics with an X. And there you can find a wide directory of union made and other ethically made products for your organization. And I guess in terms of last words, I would just say to those labor union folks out there who are listening and labor allied organizations is buy union. Unions themselves and union friendly organizations are a huge marketplace for swag items, for rallies and giveaways. There's t-shirts flying around everywhere. And if we all in the movement just decided to buy union, it would give us kind of the platform we need to increase the scale and the marketing to appeal out to the rest of the country. And so oftentimes that's not happening. If you have your swag budget and you need to buy 100 t-shirts for your local union, do it union, not just American made with a union bug, but union made with a union bug. And if that busts your budget, then buy a little bit less. Do t-shirts this year and then skip it next year. And those kinds of decisions ally the union movement with the environmental movement, which is something that needs to happen more and more over time.
Okay, great. That was Daniel Cardoso of Ethics Merchandise with an X. Thank you both very much and Happy New Year.
Oh, confronting a boss is frightful, and Lord knows they can be spiteful. Labor history does advise, organize, organize, organize. When the workers stand strong as one, it's amazing the things they can do. So much work left to do, my friend. But strikes, they are on the uptrend. So if you want better working conditions, higher pay, dignity, or a pension, together you'll win the prize. Organize, organize, organize.
I'll be home for Christmas.
You're invited to join us for a special Christmas Eve episode of the Thursday Night Special at 7 p.m. on December 24th. KKFI, in partnership with the Harriman Jewel Series, presents Holiday Bliss with international talents and KC natives tenor Ben Bliss, Americana duo Barnaby Bright, and special guests. This crooner Christmas style celebration features seasonal music, jokes, and memories. That's Holiday Bliss at 7 o'clock on Christmas Eve on KKFI. Learn more at kkfi.org/holidaybliss.
If only in my dreams.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel, and you're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show tonight is all about the naughty and nice of Christmas gifts, and we're going on to the naughty right now. We've heard about the nice, so now it's the naughty. There's been a lot of China bashing lately from President Trump, what with the virus, the trade war, and even the Russian hack of government computers, which he blamed on China. President-elect Biden also frequently sounds off against China. It's important to understand that the rivalries between great powers have more to do with competition for influence and markets, in other words, the desire of the super rich to get richer, than with any real conflict between the people. You know, as the saying goes, it's the workers who fight the rich men's wars. And so it is today with the rivalry with China, which hopefully will not lead to war. Chinese workers are not our enemies, despite the ginned-up competition for jobs promoted by politicians and even some of our unions. That's been raging since China joined the World Trade Organization back in the 1990s. But it has more to do with the decisions of the General Motors, the Apples, the Mattels, right here in the U.S. than anyone in China, least of all the workers. That being said, though, despite its so-called Communist Party, China isn't communist. It was once moving in that direction, but its revolution was reversed back in the late 1970s. The system that governs China's export markets is capitalist and driven by an authoritarian government's failure to protect workers and big global corporations that love China's system of worker discipline and cheap wages. So when it comes to the naughty, we're not talking about the workers who produce toys or other exports in China. We're talking about the government that fails to protect them and the corporations that profit off their labor. The New York-based NGO China Labor Watch has studied labor conditions and resistance since 2001 and has just published yet another report on the toy industry called Workers in Misery, an investigation into two toy factories. Last year, they published a more extensive report called The Dark Side of the Glittering World. With us to talk about it is researcher Jazz Zhang. You may need to turn up the volume to catch her words. She's not a native English speaker.
Welcome to the show, Jazz. Can you start by telling us about China Labor Watch and how you do your investigation, since you're here in the United States and the workers are over there in China?
Sure. Our organization is pretty small. It was founded by a Chinese worker, also an activist, after he came to the States in the year of 2000. And we've been working with local networks of activists, labor rights activists, researchers, and workers in China in the past two decades. So over time, we were able to gradually build our own networks. And most of the time, we also work with undercover investigators. So our partners in China would kind of, you know, secretly recruit this kind of investigators, and then they would go to actually going through the whole recruitment procedure and get hired in a real factory in China. For example, like toy factories or electronic factories, and they would work there for between 1 month and 2 months. And during that time, they write diaries and take pictures, also collect documents, whatever information they can put their hands on as much as possible. And after the investigation, after they resigned and leave the factory, we make sure they're safe. So here in the States, they would start processing and writing investigative reports based on all the documents we have.
Okay. Actually, that's a technique we use in the United States. It's called salting, where unions send people who want to organize into factories undercover.
In fact, yeah.
Yeah, I was once a salt. So,
yes, that was great.
So this is an international practice. So you recently published a study that looks at two companies that produce toys. And what were the companies, who owns them, and what toys do they produce that our listeners might recognize?
Okay, so the two toy factories, they're both located in Dongguan, which is in Guangdong Province, China.
Yeah, this is southeastern China, which a lot of Americans might know as Canton.
Yes, yeah. In Cantonese, it's like Canton. In Mandarin, it's Guangdong, but it's the same thing. So basically, one factory is fully owned by Mattel, and it's Dongguan, Chang'an Mattel Toys. And another one is called Dongguan Dongyao Toy Factory. And this one, in the factory, workers make toys for more brands, including Mattel, but also Kiko, Fisher-Price, and Tommy.
And what are some of the toys? Do you know, like the particular toys that are made there?
For example, in the factory owned by Mattel, almost inclusively female workers make Barbie dolls, like including all the little pieces, the tiny backpackers, sunglasses, whatever, all those fancy things a Barbie doll would wear.
Okay. Yeah, and I know previous studies you've done have covered factories that make Legos, which I know are very popular here.
Yeah, we've done that in the previous reports.
Yeah. You said in one of your reports that the so-called Chinese economic miracle has left workers like these toy industry workers behind. Tell us about the workers. Who are they?
These workers, we could call them migrant workers. So they're all originally from rural area of China. And starting in the late 1990s, so after China joined the WTO, it started like a huge trend that foreign enterprises would enter China and start giving Chinese factories orders. And then, especially like in the southern part of China, everything started from there. So the local government would encourage business people to build factories and receive orders from overseas. but where they hire workers. So all these factories, they would be like in suburban area, usually near a city, near major roads. So the transportation would be easier. But workers, they are from everywhere. Some of them could have come from hundreds or even thousands of miles away. So because where they came from, in the village, most of the residents are small-scale farmers. And when the traditional livelihood is fading out, only senior people like grandparents, that generation would stay back in the village, still working on their small-scale fields, less than half an acre, something like that. But young people would go travel to these factory zones and find jobs.
And a lot of them are women, right?
Yes, especially in the toy industry, because in general, Chinese factories, they like hiring women workers, because mm-hmm. women are, say, that easier to control. And although sometimes we find over 80% of the workers in toy industry, they are women. But women in the management team, the percentage is extremely low. So,
right. Yeah. And I know one of the major problems in China with migrant workers is the so-called hukou system, where you have to have a permit to live outside of where you were born. And that means that you have trouble if you have children getting them in school. Is that correct?
Absolutely. So the migrant workers, sometimes they travel to the factory, they find a job and they work there. Some of them, they met a partner or they get married, so they have kids. But they would face the problem of it's difficult for kids to get into daycare system or elementary school. So usually after a migrant worker, like a woman migrant worker has her kids, she would have to send her kids back to the village. So the grandparents would raise up the grandchildren.
So what rights do these migrant workers actually have in the workplace under Chinese law?
Well, I mean, compared with their American peers, I would say their rights are very limited because, first of all, although the labor costs in China have increased, but their labor conditions, like they still have very low wages and they often have to work overtime, extremely long working hours, for example, like 10 hours a day. It also depends on like peak season and off season. So when the factory gets a lot of orders from overseas, which means it's peak season for the workers. In that case, workers have no rights to ask for taking leave or even not to do overtime. They have to do it. And a big trouble of workers in China is there are no independent labor unions or trade unions, right? So the only labor union system is controlled by the central government from top down.
Yeah, so, and that's the All China Federation of Unions, right?
Yes. So that system basically considered more about the stability of the society. So they don't want workers to cause trouble. If workers would protest, have a strike, apparently they are causing trouble. The only purpose of that state-controlled labor union system is to not let protests or strikes happen.
Okay, so let me see if I got this right. The state policy in China is to get as much production as possible, right? Because of China's very export-oriented. And so the purpose of the unions is to make sure that the workers are disciplined and get the production out. Is that correct?
I think so. You can say so, yeah. Of course, like if a large group of workers are not treated fairly, so if they protest, if there would be a mass protest, then they probably have to compromise or negotiate with workers. But the purpose is not really for the best of the workers' benefit. They only consider how to crack everything down or calm everything down as soon as possible so the factories can keep running and keep taking more orders.
We'll get back to that one in a minute. But first, I want to get into what the working conditions are in these two toy factories in your report. Can you talk about the wages and the hours and particularly the health and safety conditions now, especially with COVID?
Sure. So in these two toy factories, we found out it was a peak season and workers have to work extremely long hours, usually 10 to 11 hours a day and 6 days a week. And talking about the wages, it differs between peak season and off season. So in the off season, usually a toy factory worker probably get about around 2,000 yuan a month, which would be about $300 a month. In peak season, because the production goal is so high, they could make $400 to $500 a month. And the health and safety wise, these workers only get minimum protection. For example, they have to use like just a regular mask and sometimes without gloves to deal with a lot of harmful chemicals to glue toy parts together and how to wash the surface, use chemical cleaners. So I don't know if you saw in the report, there are some pictures of how workers' hands were injured by these chemicals and the solutions. But usually workers, if the workers complain, the management team would just tell them just to, you know, deal with it.
Well, let me just say that the report is called Workers in Misery, an investigation of two toy factories. And you can find it by looking for China Labor Watch if you want to look at those photos. So what about COVID? Did they take particular precautions to make sure that COVID wasn't transmitted throughout the factories?
Interestingly, control of the spread of COVID in China is done at a much higher level because it happens several times, I think, after the first outbreak. But since the summer in China, once a few COVID cases were found in a city or even in a province, the Chinese government would basically lock down the whole area and try to run through a test, like test every single person in that area in a very short of time. So in that case, I haven't seen report of COVID cases in these factories, but it usually because if in a huge city, if there are only two or three cases found, everybody will get tested within a week. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's just the way how they try to control the spread of the virus.
Well, they've actually done a pretty good job compared to the United States. So let me switch a little bit. You know, you mentioned Mattel is producing toys there in their own factory there in China. So doesn't Mattel have a code of conduct that is supposed to ensure that the workers actually have safe conditions and respect for their rights, et cetera, et cetera?
Yes, they have. Actually, China Labor Watch has been working with Mattel and other major toy industrial brands in the past two decades. But the problem is, what is the enforcement of this kind of code of conduct? First of all, these workers, they don't really... they have nowhere to read or to get a copy of this kind of code of conduct. And second, if they find the violations in the factory, who would they go to ask this kind of violations be corrected?
So then you send Mattel a copy of your report, which is damning of the practices. What does Mattel do? Shouldn't they then leave China or insist that the working conditions be improved?
Because what they care about is to have their toys being produced, right? So meet their production target and get all their products, imported them on time so it can be sold in, you know, Target, Costco, all these Western stores to the consumers. What they really care is not the well-being of Chinese workers.
So it sounds like these codes of conduct are just window dressing, so to speak. There's also an international organization called the ICTI of toy manufacturers that's supposed to ensure better conditions too. Do they help at all?
I think in China, the situation is still the enforcement of all these kind of regulations. Because under the Chinese labor law, if a worker has an issue with like withholding of wages, it's probably relatively easy for them to bring the case to the court to try to get the relative government department to intervene. Mm-hmm. But speaking of all these code of conduct or international organizations out of China, then Chinese government is also not keen to try to help protect workers according to this.
Does it help for consumers in the United States to do anything?
Absolutely. I think consumers can always do their part because we always believe consumers have a right to know how the products are made. For example, if you're a parent looking for buying new toys or something your kids would enjoy, it always helps if you think how to maybe consider like supporting the local economy first. And also when you buy something made far away in China or other developing countries, also try to do a little bit investigation before you purchase it.
Okay, that's good advice, but it's going to take a lot of people doing that to make a dent. Let me ask you about workers in general in China and their resistance. I know that China has had a tremendous number of strikes. I mean, the two things that workers seem to do to protest their conditions in China is go to court and go on strike. And I remember seeing a map of strikes in China put out by the China Labor Bulletin in Hong Kong. Over the last few years, there have been massive numbers of strikes. But you told me that recently there's been a lot of repression. So can you speak a little bit about what is going on now and what Chinese President Xi Jinping is doing to try to stop it?
Interestingly, I've noticed recently there have been more protests than strikes. I think from a worker's view, it's easier to have a mass protest. And we've been noticed because usually, like right now, Chinese factories are using more and more temporary workers. They are still migrant workers. They all came from different rural areas. But they even don't, they can't stay in one place working with one factory for a long time, for example, more than half a year. It's very rare. Very few workers have worked in the factory for over a year. Most of them, they just work in one factory for 3 months, 6 months. And also, we know Chinese New Year is coming in February. So then the workers will go home, take a short break, maybe 1 or 2 weeks, and then they are looking for a next factory to work at.
It sounds like they're voting with their feet, so to speak, that they just find a better job if they can.
Yes, and a lot of protests just to demand the factory to pay them fairly.
Describe the protest. How do they put pressure on the factory?
Well, usually these protests were organized online because in China there are different social media platforms in Chinese. Mm-hmm. I know very few Westerners actually use those. WeChat is one, but there are some other ones as well. On some platforms, you can also post videos and other people can comment and you can build a group. So the group could have hundreds or thousands of members. We've noticed there are a bunch of these groups of workers. They are all workers from one factory. And the sole purpose of that group is to demand the factory pay their wages before the end of the year or before the Chinese New Year. For example, past weekend, there's a factory in Shanghai belong to Pegatron. So it's the second biggest supplier of Apple. And there would be hundreds of workers start gathering in front of the factory gate and they would chant and have slogans. And it's just try to draw the public attention. Of course, usually this kind of protest would draw public attention. although very few media reports can pass the censorship in China, but at least the workers can get part of what they requested.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much, Jazz Zhang, for talking to us and for doing this kind of reporting about China. I think it's really important that American workers understand what kind of conditions Chinese workers are facing and what kind of tactics. We can learn a lot from some of those tactics.
Thank you. I think Chinese workers, they would envy American workers because here workers have the rights to organize unions and do group bargaining negotiation. So in China, if they would have this kind of opportunities, I think there would be more movements we can report. But unfortunately, right now, the political environment is still being tightened up. So that's part of the reason our work has been impacted in the past few years.
Right. Well, I've done a bit of reading about Chinese history, and I know that Chinese working people are rather rebellious, and they don't put up with terrible conditions for long. They're known, through the centuries to rise up. So I guess we'll see what happens in the future.
I hope so. We will see.
Thank you so much. Okay.
Thank you.
That was Jazz Zhang. Their website is in English and Chinese, and you can keep up with labor news from China at chinalaborwatch.org. You can find their reports on toy makers, sweatshops, and other U.S. corporations that exploit Chinese workers. We're going to end the show with Julie McCall's Rudolph the Union Reindeer, sung by Arianna Eckel Blockman.
Rudolph the Union Reindeer pulled the sleigh for old St. Nick. He signed a union contract. He knew North Pole politics. All of the other reindeer work long hours around the clock. They paid no heed to Rudolph. They worked in non-union shops. Then one year on Christmas Eve, they all came to say, "We will do what you advise. Rudolph, help us organize." Then how the reindeer loved him as they lined up with their sleigh. Now when they work on Christmas, they're all getting premium pay.
Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show is called 2020, Looking Backward, Looking Forward, 2021. The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Keith Washburn, and stay tuned for the Thursday night special, which is Holiday Bliss, Discovery Concert Broadcast by tenor Bill Bliss and special guests. It's a Christmas Eve broadcast right here on KKFI. Join star tenor Bill Bliss, his musical family, including the band Barnaby Bright, and special guests in Holiday Bliss, presented by the Harriman Jewel Series and recorded live on Saturday, December 12th at the 1900 building.
Side by side with working people, sweating for an honest wage I'll never be ashamed of. So take it in stride, we've still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class and that's the place to be.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM, KKFI.